So you remember Krishna has killed Kamsa, gone to school, rescued his teacher's son, and when he's back in Mathura, he's feeling guilty about the residents of Vrindavan, so he sends Uddhava. And now he is thinking about other loved ones. So even more discussion this morning about how he's handling this transition in his residence. You're fine. Good morning. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Chapter 14, in Hastinapur. Kubja. Lord Krishna, who knows everything, showed interest, nonetheless, in what Uddhava said about his kin's unhappiness. While staying in Mathura with duties to address, within their hearts he showered love on Nanda and the rest. When Krishna first arrived in Mathura, he'd made a vow to see Kubja, the humble hunchbacked lady, at her house. When she had offered sandal paste to Krishna selflessly, the Lord had promptly fixed her back. She now looked heavenly. Kubja had been consumed by lust for Krishna ever since, and Krishna did not wish to keep her waiting in suspense. Her home was furnished lavishly with paintings that could fan the flames of lust and turn to dust the vows of any man. When Krishna came, Kubja stood up and welcomed him with grace. With great respect, she led him to her finest sitting place. Uddhava, too, was shown a seat, but chose the floor instead, while Krishna chose an inner room and stretched out on a bed. As Kubja prepared herself with water, oil, and fine perfume, she put on flowers, silks, and gems, and entered Krishna's room. Because all this was new to her, Kubja could only stand, so Krishna pulled the bashful, lovely woman's bangled hands. The only trace of piety Kubja had ever shown was putting sandal paste on some young man she'd never known. Today she sat beside this man, ablaze with passion's fire, and Krishna, Lord of everything, fulfilled her heart's desire. The touch and lovely fragrance of Lord Krishna's lotus feet was all Kubja required to feel sated and complete. By holding Krishna to her heart, she vanquished all distress. This former hunchback, now a beauty, said, "I've one request. Beloved Krishna, stay with me for just a few more days, and I shall make you satisfied in all delightful ways. I've waited all this time, and now my dreams are realized. How can I carry on without your smiling lotus eyes?" Lord Krishna then assured Kubja that she'd feel ever pleased. He showed her great respect and, with Uddhava, took her leave. To meet with Krishna, Lord of Lords, is difficult to do, and if one does, mere sense pleasure is not the boon to choose. Reunion with Akrura. A visit to Akrura having also been postponed, Uddhava, Balaram, and Krishna next went to his home. Akrura rose in ecstasy to see these honored guests and welcomed them exactly in accord with Vedic texts. Akrura bowed, embraced his guests, and took them to their seats. He gave them gems and other gifts and washed their lotus feet. He bowed down to the floor and sprinkled foot wash on his head. Massaging Krishna's feet in humble tones, Akrura said, "You blessed us by destroying evil Kamsa and his men. You vanquished all our misery. We're happy once again. Yes, everyone and everything is blessed by what you do, for nothing in the universe exists outside of you. You are the truth unparalleled in your whole creation. The wise can recognize your limitless incarnations. As earth and air appear in all forms of living creatures, you're one, and yet you have appeared in your countless features. You start the universe and bring it to its conclusion. Your tools, the modes, can never trap you in their illusions. Your body is your soul. You need no emancipation, and anyone who thinks you do lacks discrimination. You give the Vedas so the universe has direction. When atheists get in the way, you provide protection. You've stopped these armies steeped in criminal inclinations and blessed our family with goodness and reputation. The gods, the forefathers, mankind, and the common creatures are worshipped when we worship you, universal teacher. Who else but you could be so powerful, kind, and pleasing? You give so fully of yourself, yet without decreasing. Your simple presence is a blessing that's so exclusive, the greatest gods and yogis find it remains elusive. Our friends and families and wealth give us no solutions. Please cut the ropes of our attachment to such illusions. Akura's humble prayers always stood him in good stead. Delighted by his statements, Krishna smiled at him and said, Akura, uncle, you're our guru. We are like your sons, dependent on your empathy, regardless of what comes. We pray to serve exalted souls like you in all we do. The gods are always selfish, unlike souls as pure as you. By sacred baths and pujas one may gradually advance, but saints can purify a soul with just a single glance. Of all our friends and well-wishers, you're certainly the best. We pray now, dear Akura, that you'll grant us one request. The Pandavas are dear to us and dear to you as well. Have they survived their father's death? Dear uncle, we can't tell. They've gone to Hastinapur, under Dhritarashtra's care, and live in mortal peril, though they've taken shelter there. The sons of Dhritarashtra use their father as a toy and easily could force abuse on Kunti and her boys. Please go to see the Pandavas, and if you recommend, we'll quickly make arrangements to protect our treasured friends. Akura very happily took Krishna's words to heart. He called for his best chariot and readied to depart. Lord Krishna loves his devotees, as these two visits show. With Balaram and Uddhava, the Lord then went back home. A secret mission. Akura went to Hastinapur, site of Kuru's throne, where he had many loved ones and was very widely known. He greeted all respectfully and asked about their health, and they in turn asked him for news of family and self. For several months he scrutinized the conduct of the king, whose wicked sons and poor advisers kept him on a string. Vidura told Akura on the side in great detail how Dhritarashtra's sons tried killing Pandu's sons, but failed. He said, "The sons of Pandu have extraordinary skill. The citizens adore them and their cousins, but their cousins want them killed. Duryodhan gave them poison, though they managed to survive." Then Kunti came to see him. She disclosed with tearful eyes, "My dear Akura, gentle cousin, does my family in Mathura remember my five orphan sons and me? Do Krishna, my kind nephew, and his brother Balaram, recall their aunt and cousins now that Pandu's dead and gone? My enemies surround me here as wolves surround a doe. Will Krishna come and speak to us so we may be consoled? O Krishna, Krishna, our protector, can you hear my call? Govinda, our predicament has overwhelmed us all. For those alarmed by birth and death, what shelter is complete aside from that provided by your sacred lotus feet? I bow to you, the Lord of all, supremely pure and true. You know I need your shelter now, since all is known to you." As Kunti cried from yearning for her loved ones and her Lord, Akura and Vidura tried to offer her support. "Remember," said Akura, "though you face depressing odds, your sons can well protect you, for they are the sons of gods." King Dhritarashtra loved his nasty sons to a degree that made him treat his brother's sons with crass iniquity. Before he left, Akura came to Dhritarashtra's court with these words from Lord Krishna, who awaited his report. "Enhancer of the Kuru's fame, your state is widely known. Upon your brother's death, you have assumed the royal throne. By being noble, strong, and fair in everything you do, success, respect, and high regard will surely come to you. However, if you falter, who will ever wish you well? In this world you will be condemned, and then you'll enter hell. Be equal, prudent king. Thus far, the love that you have shown is skimpy for your brother's sons and wasted on your own. In this world, who can stay involved with any wife or son? Our bond with our own body will itself be soon undone. Alone the soul must take its birth, Alone again it dies. Alone it takes its karma, be it punishment or prize. Dependents take away whatever wealth a man might hold, as offspring from a fish drink up the water in his bowl. A fool performs 1,000 sins to keep his children fed. His children keep the food, and he the sins when he is dead. Abandoned, blind, and ignorant, the fool who fails his soul discovers that his loved ones fail to pay his karmic toll. To understand your life is but a dream that's bound to cease will bolster your intelligence and bring you inner peace. Said Dhritarashtra, "Gracious soul, I fully understand. Your words to me are heaven's nectar for a common man. And yet my heart leans to my sons, so everything you say remains like lightning in the clouds that flares but doesn't stay. Lord Krishna comes to bless the earth and ease its crushing weight. Who dares defy this dazzling soul whose energies create a universe complete with nature's full variety that we try to exploit while he observes us patiently?" Akrura thought about King Dhritarashtra's baffled mood. He bows to God while clinging to a selfish attitude. Departing with permission from his relatives and peers, he brought news of the Pandavas to Krishna's waiting ears. Chapter 15. In Dwaraka, Jarasandha attacks. Asti and Prapti, Kamsa's widows, feeling dispossessed, left Mathura and went back to their parents in distress. Jarasandha, their father, ruler of the Magda state, was furious to hear about his daughter's husband's fate. Jarasandha, a powerful and cruel wicked man, announced, "I vow to rid this world of Krishna and his clan." Then, feeling sure his troops would quickly smash the opposition, he launched a siege of Mathura with 23 divisions. When they saw this attacking army swelling like a sea, the citizens of Mathura felt great anxiety. Though Krishna saw conditions he could easily adjust, he comes for certain reasons, so he started thinking thus. "So many soldiers, chariots, and elephants have come. I'm here to lift earth's burdens, and this force is surely one. They all shall die, but I shall free Jarasandha, for then he'll go away and recreate his army once again. I save those who are pious and destroy those who are not, so I shall end this army and the suffering they've wrought. In other days and other ways, in other sights and climes, I've vanquished irreligion when it flares from time to time." At once two golden, transcendental chariots appeared, complete with horses, drivers, shields, and military gear. His chakra in his hand and golden helmet on his head, Lord Krishna called for Balaram and courteously said, "Respected elder brother, your dependents need your help. Your chariot and weapons are awaiting your good self. Remove these evil soldiers from this planet, if you please, for after all, we've come to earth to save our devotees." Resplendent in their armor, and without a moment's wait, the brothers and 100 men rode past the city's gates. Although his force was tiny, Krishna's mighty conch shell blast alarmed Jarasandha and the divisions he'd amassed. Jarasandha looked mockingly at Krishna and declared, "I will not fight with you, mere boy, for that would be unfair. You killed your uncle Kamsa. Go away, you craven fool. Now, Balaram, if you're not scared, I'll fight you in a duel." Said Krishna, "Heroes never boast. They simply show their skill. You speak deceits like these to ease the fear of being killed. And then, as dust obscures a flame, or clouds obscure the sun, the army circled Krishna's troops, 4,000 men to one." When Krishna was surrounded, and from all appearance doomed, the women, looking on from Mathura, felt faint and swooned. The archers of Jarasandha fired arrows by the score, so Krishna drew his fabled bow, which all the gods adore. Lord Krishna's arrows, razor sharp, became an endless blaze that slaughtered men on horse and foot who rushed him from all ways. The horses, men, and elephants fell dead in great surprise as Krishna's arrow split their heads and sliced their arms and thighs. The severed necks and limbs of men and beasts released their blood, which grew into a current that became a crimson flood. That bloody river snakes were arms, its turtles severed heads, and islands formed where elephants lay in that river dead. The hands and thighs appeared like fish, the human hair like weeds. Abandoned bows were ripples, other weapons brush and reeds. The floating wheels of chariots revolved like swirling pools. The gravel in that bloody stream was ornaments and jewels. The flow of blood, which shocked those souls who watched with timid eyes, aroused a sense of great relief and joy among the wise. Lord Krishna used his arrows, and Lord Balaram his plow, and neither showed a speck of perspiration on their brows. Why should one be surprised when God annihilates his foes? For he creates and dictates all, as everybody knows. Though Krishna has no need to fight, no kingdom to be gained, his actions can attract lost souls, as sages have explained. Jarasandha's great army was completely put to death. Jarasandha was caught and bound, the only demon left. But Krishna ordered him released. He had a plan to fill. So Balaram untied his ropes, obliging Krishna's will. Jarasandha, once highly honored, trudged away in shame and pledged himself to penance to restore his tarnished name. But then his friends persuaded him that he should fight again. They said, "Your loss is just the cost one pays for former sins." Lord Krishna entered Mathura. He hadn't lost a man. The gods tossed fragrant flowers, and a festival began. The people, free of fearfulness and ready to rejoice, cheered loud and long as bards raised song in strong, proficient voice. As conches blared and kettle drums laid down a booming beat, the citizens strung banners and splashed perfume in the streets. The flutes and vinas sweetly played as priests sang Vedic hymns, and everyone felt happier than they had ever been. The women gazed at Krishna with affection-laden eyes and showered him with garlands, blooms, and freshly toasted rice. The Lord, whose glance had liberated all the slaughtered men, presented Ugrasen, the king, with piles of captured gems. Again Jarasandha assembled soldiers by the score, but Krishna cut down every one just as he'd done before. And still another 15 times the fool launched vain attacks, and as the soldiers fell, the overburdened earth relaxed. Constructing Dwarka. As Krishna's plan unfurled and ran precisely on its course, Jarasandha began to build another fighting force. However, Kalayavana, a beast, arrived there first, with soldiers by the millions to turn Mathura to dirt. Lord Krishna said to Balaram about this latest threat, "An ancient curse upon the Yadus has this rogue upset. Jarasandha could come while Kalayavana attacks and steal or kill our relatives behind our very backs. We must construct a fortress that will keep away these beasts so everyone in Mathura again can live in peace. We'll call this fortress Dwarka. I'll set it up tonight. We'll relocate our citizens, then come back here to fight." Lord Balaram agreed in full, so Krishna instantly produced a fort 100 miles wide within the sea. We couldn't float a single stone, but Krishna's God. As such, he floats the stars and planets, so for him this wasn't much. The fortress, known as Dwarka, stood tall and bright and grand. Broad avenues surrounded public parks on ample land that boasted fragrant trees and vines that demigods supplied, along with golden gates and spires that seemed to touch the sky. The houses, too, were made of gold, with emeralds for floors. find gem-encrusted crowns and golden pots outside their doors. The dwellings were luxurious for every rank and class, with watchtowers and temple rooms and stables made of brass. Lord Krishna's many palaces lined clean, enormous streets. The gods each brought a certain gift to make the fort complete. From heaven, Indra brought a parijata tree and the Sudharma meeting hall, where all gained immortality. Varuna offered horses of a most distinctive kind, with varied hues, both white and blue, and swifter than the mind. Kubera gave 8 mystic gifts, assuring all of wealth, and other gods and goddesses gave richly of themselves. The people went to sleep in Mathura that mystic night, and woke up in their rich new homes, amazed in great delight. And meanwhile, Balaram and Krishna planned new strategies to end the threat designed and set by these 2 enemies. The death of Kalayavana. That morning, Kalayavana's enormous, brutish force saw Krishna exit Mathura without a bow or horse. They seethed to see that Krishna held them in such low respect that he would walk outside unarmed, a garland on his neck. When Kalayavana saw Krishna nonchalant and bold, he noted how his enemy was pleasant to behold. The Lord's dark blue complexion and his eyes tinged lotus pink made Kalayavana look twice, stand still, and crudely think, "This Krishna has the mark known as Srivatsa on his chest. The famed Kaustubha gem hangs on his neck. He has the rest of Vishnu's special qualities, as Narada describes. But he has insulted me, so I shall tear him up alive." So Kalayavana threw down his weapons on the spot and dashed off after Krishna, sure he'd easily be caught. Lord Krishna turned and ran away, the fiend in hot pursuit, a fool absorbed in hope to apprehend the Absolute. Remaining just beyond the range of every grasp he gave, Lord Krishna guided Kalayavana inside a cave. The fiend cried, "Stop, you coward! Now your reputation's stained!" But he could not catch Krishna, for his karma still remained. Lord Krishna ran inside the cave, ignoring these remarks. When Kalayavana ran in, he stumbled in the dark upon a man who lay at rest and gave him no regard. "He runs, lies down, and hides," the demon cried, and kicked him hard. The sleeping man was someone else who'd long been resting there. He lifted heavy eyelids, looked about, and grew aware of Kalayavana, who stood by staring, unabashed. Those sleepy eyes fell on the demon, burning him to ash. King Vishnurata, listening for hours without a word, at once put forth this question after hearing what occurred. Who was this man who lived in caves and yet was so adept that he could burn to ashes one who woke him when he slept? Said Sukadeva, "This man named Muchakunda was renowned as one who cares for Brahmins and who always keeps his vow. He once enjoyed a kingdom, but he set his throne aside when Indra came to him and begged, 'The gods are terrified. The demons have attacked us, and we fear they may succeed. Since you are the strongest mortal king and famous for your deeds, take up your sword and lead our forces. When this war is through, the gods will do whatever you may wish for them to do.' He fought for years till Shiva's son took charge of heaven's troops. The gods said, 'Muchakunda, you have been most resolute. Since we no longer need you, we release you from your vow. So if you want a benediction, ask it of us now. You set aside a kingdom that was strong and unopposed, and selflessly took up the heavy task that we proposed. Because you went to heaven, though, to stop the demons' crimes, your children, queen, and friends have died. They lived on mortal time. A minute passed in heaven is a year for earthly men, yet even here the hand of God, as time, will do us in. Now take your choice of boons from us to savor while you live, except for liberation, which the Lord alone can give.' 'If that's the case,' said Muchakunda, 'what could I desire? My kingdom's gone, I fought so long, and I've become so tired that all I can look forward to is long and peaceful rest. So this, O gods, shall be the benediction I request. Allow me to remain asleep for days or weeks or years, as long as I may wish. And if someone should interfere, let's say a god in peril who implores me to return, a glance from my awakened eyes will make that person burn. The gods could understand that Muchukunda wanted peace. They granted his bizarre request and gave him his release. So Muchukunda found a place where he would never wake till foolish Kalyavana performed his last mistake. Then Krishna, who knew all of this, revealed his splendid form before King Muchukunda, who was instantly transformed. Astonished by the beautiful effulgence he displayed, the pious king stared straight at Krishna, shook his head, and prayed, "Who are you? Why have such soft feet traversed this thorny ground? Are you Lord Indra, Chandra, Agni, someone more renowned? You must be God himself, for in this cave, as dark as night, the luster of your body has filled everything with light." The king explained his story, and the vow he undertook, and said, "Your luster stuns me. I can scarcely bear to look. My lord, please tell me of yourself, if that would be allowed." Lord Krishna, pleased, replied in words as deep as rumbling clouds, "Dear king, my births are thousands, and my name's the same amount. In fact, I've had more births and names than I can even count. If one could count earth's particles of dust on hands and knees, he'd still not count my births or names, my deeds or qualities. Great sages, list my present, past, and future deeds, dear friend. Despite their patient efforts, they have never reached the end. Some time ago, Brahma requested me to save the earth, so I became the son of Vasudeva and took this birth. Through me, Pralamba, Kangsa, and their kind met their demise. Now you've burned Kalyavana, this demon, with your eyes. Since in the past, repeatedly, you've offered prayers to me, I've met you in this cave, for I'm inclined to devotees. My dear and saintly Muchukunda, take some blessing, please. I'll give you anything you ask and put your mind at ease. If someone somehow satisfies and proves himself to me, he never need again lament or suffer misery." On hearing this, the king bowed down, his forehead to the ground. Sage Garga had foretold he'd see the Lord, and now he found the Lord himself had come to him in such a perfect way. Rejoicing in his fortune, Muchukunda gently prayed, "My Lord, the men and women of this world are most confused of your divine illusion. Thus they fail to worship you. Oblivious to their own good, they build up families that fail to bring them happiness and cause them miseries. A soul who squanders human life forgetting you will dwell within some mortal home as if a beast trapped in a well. Intoxicated by my wealth, my wives, and my domain, I thought myself this mortal flesh and suffered endless pain. I arrogantly raised an army, roamed the earth, and thought my body was eternal, though it's obviously not. A greedy fool like me ignores you till you come at last as death, a hungry snake devouring blind and helpless rats. A body riding elephants or chariots of gold is called the king and flaunted for the public to behold. And then your endless form of time renames that royal corpse as feces, worms, or ashes when its lifetime runs its course. I conquered all directions. When my splendid throne was raised, my former enemies bowed down to me and gave me praise. But when I went to see my queen, my sovereignty was gone, and I became her pet, a helpless beast to be led on. A king desiring happiness performs austerity and overcomes his self-important, proud mentality. When one stops chasing matter, he may meet your devotee and gain a realization of your true supremacy. To see you here has ended my affection for my throne. A wise king leaves his empire for the woods and lives alone. Devotees serve your lotus feet. Please let me do the same. Why should I ask a boon that brings entanglement and pain? Henceforward, I renounce those things I used to want to do. Relieved of such attachments, may I now depend on you? You have no designations. You are undiluted proof that nature, goodness, darkness, passion, can't obscure the truth. My senses can't be satisfied. They'll never give me peace. I'm trapped and burning in this world and cannot gain release. Protect me, Lord. This world is just a dangerous masquerade. To serve your lotus feet will make me pleased and unafraid. The Lord replied, Great ruler, you've a clear and potent mind. You could have taken any boon from me were you inclined. I offered you some blessing just to prove that you are pure. The honor of my unalloyed devotees is secure. Though yogis master breathing drills, their inner mental state remains a site for sensual desire to incubate. Your mind has no such problems. It is simply fixed on me. Now, wander where you will with your unfailing loyalty. Because you were a Kshatriya, you've killed both man and beast, incurring many sins from which you now must be released. Perform your penance in this life, and surely in the next you'll come back as a Brahmin and achieve complete success. King Muchakunda honored Krishna, left the cave and smiled. Of course, he had not been outside at all in quite a while. The Kali Age has come, the monarch quickly realized. The people, beasts, and trees he saw had shrunk in rank and size. The sober king was firm and transcendental. Going forth, he reached Bhadarik Ashram in the distant, frigid north. He worshipped Lord Narayan and remained there peacefully in constant thought of Krishna through severe austerity. Sagar Prabhu.
So, these pastimes are interestingly very full of prayers. Can anyone name the different devotees who gave prayers? Kubja, yeah. Akrur, and then Kujakunda. No, not Kaliwa. There's one more actually. Can anyone point out? It's hidden. There's Jarasandha. Even he actually gave prayers in one sense. That will be revealed in the lecture. So, going next. I'll focus mostly on the prayers of Akrura, Jarasandha, and Muchukunda. So it's interesting when Krishna arrives at Akrura's place, it shows the Vedic way of welcoming guests. It's very elaborate. And in the general, when someone arrives, the host will flatter them or say praises. But here we see Akrura is not just simply praising Krishna, but he also, as we see in other pastimes, he is giving very philosophical points why Krishna is Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he starts with different points. So he starts with just everything comes from Agni, all these things manifest from these material elements. Everything comes from you, and you're supreme because everyone else is entangled in karma. Everyone is bonded, but except for you. So it's interesting, and then Krishna starts asking questions, it reminded me of the pastime of Ramananda Rai, where Lord Chaitanya starts asking questions, even though Lord Chaitanya knows everything himself. So Krishna also here starts asking questions in this, over here. Let's see. So Akrura says, therefore you are the one supreme lord of the universe. You are not bound up like the living entities by karma and the three modes of nature. And Krishna replies, how is that that I am not bound up? And Akrura answers, as you are the embodiment of knowledge, what is the question of being bound up by this ignorance? Ignorance exists for the living entities, but not for you. Krishna said, if there is no ignorance in me, then where does this body of mine, a product of ignorance, come from? Akrura said, your body is not designated as coming from ignorance by those who know the scriptures. Therefore, you have no birth or material existence like the living entities. If your body appears to be material, it is only an appearance of birth like the living entities, since you are actually independent. As you do not have a material body born of ignorance, you do not take birth from a father's semen like an ordinary living entity. Rather, your birth is just your divine appearance. For you, there is no difference between body and soul. Your body is you, as is proved by the statement, Deha Dehi Vibhago Yam Neshvara Vidyate Kvachit. There is no distinction between the body and soul of the Supreme Personality of Godhead at any time. And Krishna asks, But my bondage and liberation do occur, as when I am bound to a mortar by my mother, or I am delivered from Kalia's lake, Akrura. Those do indeed occur, but only because you do not prohibit them from occurring. Why do you accept bondage and liberation? You do so out of your free will, Nikama, because of their appropriateness for meditation by us, your devotees. Since you enact this bondage and liberation in full knowledge, they are not at all caused by illusion. For him who is knowledge itself, there is no bondage to or liberation from this world, which is produced by ignorance. So it's interesting how Krishna keeps asking these questions and Akrura starts giving the answers, even though Krishna pretty much knows everything. So it's another way of like Krishna using devotees to glorify himself. And it's a very sweet pastime how they keep asking. And then Krishna goes on to praise Akrura. Actually, in this pastime, Krishna is actually bewildering Akrura by overly revealing his glories to Akrura. He's actually revealing all this. And in one sense, Akrura is getting bewildered by all this opulence and he's saying all these prayers. So we can see that only by the sweet will of the Lord, all these glories are coming out. And then Krishna starts praising Akrura. He says, since we are like your sons, you deserve our respect. But since you are a great Vaishnav, and this is like the transcendental perspective, he's saying, since you are a great Vaishnav, so you deserve our respect. So it's very interesting, like Krishna himself is saying, since you are a devotee, you know, you should get respect. So, and then Krishna said, O Akrura, even from the ordinary point of view, you deserve our honor. But from the transcendental perspective, you are the most worshipable because you are a first-class Vaishnav. And then Krishna said, among those worthy of worship, you are most worshipable. But now Akrura starts asking questions. It's interesting, even though Akrura like totally established that Krishna is the supreme, now Akrura starts asking questions. But isn't it a well-established fact that men should worship the demigods? Krishna says, the demigods are basically self-interested, but the devotees are not. They're primarily interested in benefiting others. Then Akrura again asks, are not the holy waters worthy of worship? Shaking his head, Krishna said, no. Though certainly the holy waters and the demigods purify, but that is very different from the purification through the devotees. The holy waters give purification by prolonged service, but the devotees give purification just by seeing them. So, and then Krishna goes ahead to say that, since you are our uncle and you're a relative and also you're a great devotee, and a devotee is, you know, he's Suhrid Dehinam, so he's always looking for the welfare of everyone. So he said, that's why you go to Hastinapur, because to check on Queen Kunti and her sons. So these were the two reasons which logically came out of this prayer and conversation. And then we come to Jarasandha's prayers. It's interesting, when Jarasandha looked at Lord Krishna at the battlefield, the literal meaning of what he said was, O Krishna, lowest of men, I am ashamed to fight with you, a mere boy who hides himself in Gokula as a Vaishya. O fool, O killer of your uncle, I will not fight with you, go away. But Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he says, like the Sanskrit, the words can be rearranged and meaning can be totally different. So this translation is given by him, and he says, Jarasandha, it can also be interpreted that Jarasandha is saying, O great personality to whom all others are inferior. In other words, Jarasandha is saying, Krishna is the Purushottama, best of living entities. I will not fight with you, whose child is Brahma, for you are the Lord of all Lords. I'm ashamed to fight with you because I have lived a sinful life. I'm unqualified. You are hidden. It's interesting, in the original translation it's like, you hide in Gokula, but here it's saying, you are hidden in everyone's heart, and are therefore invisible to the material vision. So I do not desire to fight with you. And then Jarasandha goes on to Lord Balaram and he says, you, Ram, should gather your courage and fight with me. If you think you can do it, you may either give up your body when it is cut to pieces by my arrows and thus attain to heaven, or else kill me. And another meaning, in one sense, prayer, it can be like, go away from me since I am so sinful and go to Vaikuntha having left aside my body cut by arrows. So it's the reverse, like he's saying, you cut my body rather than me pounding on you. And this question came up also in the poem and also this book, like, since Krishna is like, you know, he's God, you know, like he's all powerful. So why does he enjoy like fighting these teeny people like Jarasandha? Like, I mean, if you see, if you compare, like he's God, why is Krishna getting so much glorification? I mean, this is like an unfit match between God and this one small king. But it's Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that since Krishna is here in his original, is in his human form, so it is worthy of praise. And also, like, these pastimes are to show different lessons to the human mankind in general. But also at the same time, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that Krishna still, the original form of Krishna is the two-handed form. So that shouldn't be confused with. And then next is the Kalyavan and Muchakonda. So Kalyavan was interestingly sent by Narada Muni. And Kalyavan was the son of Gargya, who was the son of Garga Muni. And at one point, Gargya was insulted by the Yadavas because they laughed at him for some reason. And so he said, okay, now I'll give birth to a son who will, you know, who will take my revenge. So basically, Gargya gave birth to Kalyavana through the princess of the king of Yavanas. So at one point, Kalyavana, he meets Narada Muni and he asks, who are the most powerful warriors? And Narada Muni says, oh, the Yadavas, go and fight. So basically that's how, like, Narada Muni totally, like, as he does, you know, he's like a catalyst for Krishna's pastimes. So he sends this demon. And it's interesting when Kalyavana meets Krishna, and there's a stark difference between Kalyavana meeting Krishna and Muchakunda meeting Krishna. So it's the same, you know, it's the same Krishna in front of them. It's like with the jewel and all the marks and with the garland. So it is all the same. But Kalyavana, since he has an inimical attitude, he cannot perceive, even though Krishna is just standing in front of him. And rather he gets insulted that this man thinks of me so lowly that he has come unarmed. So he gives away his stuff and then he runs after Krishna like, oh, I'll catch Krishna. But it's described that since Kalyavana hasn't, like, he still has sinful reactions to bear, so he cannot catch the absolute truth. And since he has an inimical attitude, he cannot catch the absolute truth. And like Krishna is like, you know, Krishna is very playful. He's not like, it's not like it's a serious war for Krishna. Krishna is just, you know, playful. And like Krishna is running, na 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 na. Like Kalyavana is running back and back and back. And they're running and running. And then Krishna enters this cave. And then Kalyavana is rather like, oh, you coward. Like, why are you hiding in a cave? You are a great warrior. And then this Kalyavana is so foolish, for some reason he thinks Krishna will just sleep over there. So he kicks this guy. So he starts kicking this guy, and it's Muchakunda. And Muchakunda, when he opens his eyes, he's burnt to ashes. So it's described like, Muchakunda, he was requested by Indra to fight the demons. And so he was very pious, very righteous, and like, so I'll fight. And he fought for a long time. And then when the war ended and Kartikeya, son of Shiva, he came to take up the position, like all his kingdom was gone because due to the time effect. So all the wives, all his son, everything was gone. And he said, you know, I'm very tired. And it's interesting, it also says like it's a bizarre request, you know, I want to sleep, I'm tired. It's a demigod. So demigods can offer anything. Like, as we were reading, like, the Varuna gave horses swifter than the mind. It's interesting. I was listening once. What is swifter than the mind? Like, New York. The horses are swifter than that. So can you imagine so much? And the demigod said, we can give all this. And he said, I just want to sleep. Yeah. So there's a reason. Because, Gargamuni had predicted that Muchakunda, he's in the beginning of Manvantara, and Garga Muni predicted that Krishna will come off in the 28th millennium. So after like four cycles of yugas. So this prediction was there, and Garga Muni also predicted that you will see Krishna. So that's why, this is the reason why Muchakunda asked for this bizarre request that I want to sleep, no one should wake me. And also he specifically asked for this request, this boon that anyone who will wake me will be burned to ashes, because he didn't want Indra to wake him up again for wars, like, because Indra was now scared, like, I can't wake him up to help me with the wars, because I'll just be burned to ashes. So Mujukunda was sleeping peacefully for 4 cycles of yugas, and very long. And then Krishna, and also, like, he kept offering prayers. He was a great devotee, so Krishna knew all this. You know, he kept Mujukunda in his mind. And so, as when he woke up and he saw Krishna, and he was totally, like, enthralled. Can you imagine, like, after sleeping for 4 yugas, you see the Supreme Personality of Godhead? So, he was like, oh, who is this? Who is this? He couldn't even, like, tell who is this. He was asking, are you Agni God, or, like, Surya God, or are you Indra? Or who are you? Let's see what he says. Yeah, who are you? Who are you who have come to this mountain cave in the forest, having walked on the thorny ground with feet as soft as lotus petals? Perhaps you are the potent of all potent beings, or maybe you are the powerful god of fire, or sun god, the moon god, the king of heaven, Indra, or the ruling demigod of some other planet. I think you are the supreme personality among the 3 chief gods. That kind of, I think it means Vishnu, I guess. Since you dry away the darkness of this cave as a lamp dispels darkness with its light. O best among men, if you like, please truly describe your birth, activities, and lineage to us who are eager to hear. So it's interesting. Mujukunda says, please truly describe your birth, activities, and lineage to us. Is this Mujukunda? Why is he saying us? It's described, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, since he's a royal king, you know, so like you know, kings say, we, us. So it's like that. So in one sense, he's also telling, so this is like a royal attitude. When you talk to someone, you want to make sure that you are qualified to talk to him and he's qualified to talk to you. So Mujukunda is doing the same. He's trying to show that, you know, I'm qualified. He does not have pride, but this is the code of talking, I guess, with the kings. So that's how he's talking. And then Krishna actually doesn't say anything. Krishna is smiling, standing there. And then Mujukunda feels, okay, like he's not saying, so I guess I should introduce myself further. So he goes on to say, as for ourselves, O tiger among men, we belong to a family of fallen Kshatriyas, descendants of King Ishvaku. My name is Mujukunda, my lord, and I am the son of Yavanashvara. And then Mujukunda describes a little bit more about himself. And then Krishna reciprocates in the same way. Krishna is saying that he is highly qualified, and he is describing all his qualifications, but at the same time, he does not have any pride. So Krishna says, okay, so I'll also describe all my glories, but even though I am prideless. So Krishna goes on to describe, Krishna gives this philosophy that I have taken thousands of births, lived thousands of life, and so on and so forth. All this we have read. And then he goes to describe this particular appearance in this pastime, that he was born the son of Vasudeva over here in the Yadu dynasty. And then Krishna asks, okay, now I'm very pleased with you. So if you want a boon, please, you can ask any boon. And it's interesting again because initially the demigods offered boon, now Krishna is offering boon. And so again, like everyone can get excited. Oh, I want something, you know, like this huge thing. But Mujukunda is a pure devotee, like he is an unalloyed devotee. So Krishna is actually testing him and at the same time showing that how the intelligence of an unalloyed devotee is not wavered. So again, Mujukunda at this point, he starts pounding on material life. He gives very heavy statements like, you know, that everyone is bewildered by your external energy, Maya. Thus, they do not worship your lotus feet. These pleasures are available even to hogs and dogs, so it is foolish to not worship you in this human body. And Mujukunda calls these things as greed of grass. So he calls all this material opulence basically grass, and people have the greed for it. So he's saying, further he goes, like, myself being attached to worldly opulences, I've suffered enough anxiety. Because if you see, like, you know, he is a great devotee, so he knows all this. And then he compares Krishna to, like, a snake. He says, like, people in general are indulged in material life, and then you are like the snake. He describes snake like it lips, it's like does like that, I guess, I don't know. Like it has its tongue wavering all the time, and then it snatches in the end. That is like death. So Krishna is like waiting like a snake, you know, looking at this guy having fun, like a rat in the hole, like having fun, and then in the end, like death comes and takes this rat. It's described like that. He describes like that. And then he goes on to say, like, we are great warriors outside, but like a pet in front of our wives, and so on and so forth. And then so this is like the grossest material life. And then he goes to describe one who's pious and does numerous activities and other things, that person, he starts thinking, I'm the supreme and independent. And thus he cannot attain happiness because, like, when you think I'm the supreme and independent, there is actually so much anxiety. Because you are not the supreme and independent, but you want to exert that you are the supreme and the independent. But then he goes on to say that when one meets your devotee, all the above material life ends. And also the effect is very quick. It's described in the Sanskrit, it's written as like, when the material life ends, then you meet the devotee. But Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that actually when you meet the devotee, then the material life ends, not the reverse. But it's written like this because the effect is so quick. Like, as soon as you meet the devotee, all the material entangles are gone away. And we can see, like, if we think in the big picture, like, you know, we have been here for quite some time, like minions, I guess several yugas, many lifetimes. But we joined this movement, and, like, within, say, like we have so many examples, like you know, Nandkumar Prabhu, like, for example, like, in a short time of 10 years, you know, he's nice version of. So if we compare this 10 years to the whole spectrum of, you know, millions of lifetimes, it is actually like, you know, flicker of second. Like, so we shouldn't be disappointed. It is still time. So it is actually like that. So that's why it says, that's why it's like that. But when you meet the devotee, all the material life ends. And then Mujhakunda then goes further to denounce liberation. And he gives this argument that liberation is mixed with mode of goodness, since it is based on knowledge, so I reject it. So it's not transcendental to the modes. And he says that I pray only for your service, which is beyond the three modes. And then again Krishna starts asking questions to him. Let's see. Krishna asks, again, it's the same questions. Krishna is asking, but I am bound in these three modes. Like almost the same questions he asked to Akrura. So Krishna says, but some say that my form as a person is Brahman, covered by Maya. Mujhakunda said, no, you're without any material coverings and completely transcendental to the material modes. So here, like Krishna, we can see Krishna is actually denouncing the Mayavad philosophy. It's like, you know, Brahman covered by Maya. Krishna is himself using his devotee to totally reject this philosophy of the Mayavad. And then Krishna again asks, yes, I may be without gunas, but some people say that my present body is made of the gunas. Then Mujhakunda says, you and your body are not different. Rather, your body is you. Krishna, then what is the real identity of my body? Mujhakunda says, it is made of pure knowledge. Chit Sarupa, Gyapti Matram. Yeah, so these are the only questions Krishna asks him, and he establishes how he is non-different from his body, and he totally the Mayavad philosophy rejected over here. And then Mujhakunda in the end says, I've experienced all this material opulence, like do hell to all this material opulence, do hell to liberation. All I want is service because that is beyond the modes, and there is no anxiety in that. So then Krishna starts glorifying that, yes, you are my unalloyed devotee and I was testing you. And then, so he wanted to be with Krishna. Mujhakunda wanted Krishna's association. But Krishna gave this argument that because you followed the principles of a Kshatriya, you killed living beings while hunting and performing your duties. You must vanquish the sins thus incurred by carefully executing penances while remaining surrendered to me. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that Krishna is actually kind of lying over here, that it is not the main reason. Actually, the main reason is, he states over here, that Krishna thought as follows. In this incarnation, Mujhakunda should not associate with me directly. All the personal assistants in my pastimes have taken birth in Dwapar Yuga, such as Uddhava, Akrura, Arjun, Yudhishthira, and Uddhava. Mujhakunda, however, is extremely old, having taken birth at the very beginning of this Manvantara.
When people see him, they will laugh and say, "Aha, who is this very tall and stout man who is such a poor match for the Lord?" Even now, during the pastime of fleeing from Jarasandha, as well as in later pastimes such as kidnapping of Rukmini, it will not be at all fitting for this person to be associated with me while I am fighting the likes of Shalva and others. He will take these opponents of mine and crush them in their hands like mosquitoes. What excuse can I make up, therefore, to separate him from my association? So Krishna was thinking like this, and so he gave this argument that you still have sinful reactions because you're a Kshatriya. No, yeah, it will be a mismatch, and like also like he's very old, and from the beginning of the Manvantara, so he's like huge. He's huge actually, because when he goes out, it says, you know, he sees this Kali Yuga, everyone is short, so he's actually very huge. And so he'll just crush pretty much everyone. And there'll be no, I don't know if there'll be any fun then, like just one guy killing everyone. So this was Krishna's desire. So Krishna gave this argument and then he said, in the poem it said that he will come back as a Brahmin. But here in Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says, Krishna said that after leaving this body, you will go to my abode in Vaikuntha. I give you liberation and also residence in Vaikuntha. Even to my enemies, I give this liberation. In my pastimes, in a future incarnation, you will associate with me as an essential participant. In your very next birth, you will be the best friend of all living entities. At that time, you and I will act for the benefit by giving them transcendental knowledge as suits the circumstances. So, it's interesting, like Krishna gave him liberation, but at the same time, I guess he came back as a Brahmin to assist Krishna in his pastimes. Do you know anything about how when Muchukunda came back? It can be any of the universes, any of the incarnations. So these were the main points, and I guess I don't know if there are any questions. Yes. This was one reasoning.
Self-interest.
Yeah, that is also true.
I read that in the Krishna. I can't hear. Uncle,
I can't hear you. I can repeat it. So basically he's saying the demigods I don't want to name anyone, but like certain demigods and like administrative positions, they have this, you know, tendency for power, and they are like covered by the modes in one sense, you know, because they're still in the material sky. But then there are exalted devotees like Shiva, Durga, like someone like them, they are above the modes. But still there are demigods who are covered by these material modes. So in that sense, like, you know, that's why these demigods should not be worshipped. Let me get that. Yeah, I think I remember where it is. Oh, okay. So I guess I can tell you later, I guess. So anyways, thank you very much.